Brett, sometimes I dream of becoming an actor. Have you ever dreamt of becoming an actor? Maureen, what is it you think I do for a living? Never mind, sounds like you need the New York Film Academy. NYFA offers workshops, BFA and MFA degrees and summer camps in filmmaking, acting, journalism and more, online and on campuses across the globe. To make films alongside industry professionals, explore more at nyfa.edu. Thanks, Brett. Thank you, Maureen.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase, every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Look out, it's only films to be buried with.
Hello and welcome to Films to be Buried With. My name is Brett Goldstein. I'm a comedian, an actor, a writer, a director, a tree, and I love films. As Dr. Zeus once said, how did it get so late so soon? We're nearly on episode 200. Does this mean we have to say goodbye? I don't want to say goodbye. Maybe I won't. Maybe I'll just take a break for a bit. We'll see, I guess. Wow, that's quite a niche quote from Dr. Zeus there. I hope he's all right. Every week I invite a special guest over. I tell them they've died. Then I get them to discuss their life through the films that meant the most to them. But this week is a very special and bang on time Films of 2021 special. The end of year special with Nish Kumar. Part one. It's too early, you say? I think we're right on time. There's also a Patreon to this podcast at patreon.com/Brett Goldstein, where you get extra long episodes, secrets from the guests, and whole eps, uncut, ad-free. Check it out over at patreon.com/Brett Goldstein. Tickets are selling fast for the big live Films to be Buried With live at the Hackney Empire on July 2nd. Make sure you get your tickets from plosive.co.uk or hackneyempire.co.uk. So here we are, very much the episode you've been waiting for. It's me and Nish Kumar going over the films of the year 2021. We tried to make it a tight hour, obviously went over by an hour, which is why this is now a two-parter. It's always a delight to talk with Nish. I loved it. I love him. You will too. So that is it for now. Hope you're all well, and I very much hope you enjoy episode 198 of Films to be Buried With. Hello and welcome to Films to be Buried With, the end of the year special. It is I, Brett Goldstein, and I am joined today by a man who has died, been brought back to life, died, died again. And we're not just talking about his tour, we're talking to Nish Kumar. Please welcome to the show, the amazing, the wonderful. He's a lovely boy and a very clever man, a very funny comedian. And also a brilliant mind and someone I would love to hear their views on any subject, particularly whilst I'm on the toilet. Please welcome to the show. He's here. He's uncut. It's Mr. Nish Kumar.
Hello, Brett. I enjoy the strict adherence to my Hindu beliefs that I just keep dying and coming back again on the podcast. I just keep dying and coming back again on the podcast.
Yeah, I see. And you get better every time. And
and should we? I guess we should start by addressing the elephant in the room, that it's the 7th of May, 2022, as we record.
Is this the earliest we've done films of the year? We are doing the films of 2021. As you well know, I never want to make a decision at the end of the year having maybe missed a film. So it's taken this long to see all of the films of 2021. I've now seen them all. Have you?
Yeah, we've seen them all. I mean, I feel at some point like the snake is going to eat itself and eventually we'll be recording. I think to be safe, we should actually record in December for the whole previous year.
That is a good idea. I mean, I think I've seen everything and I'm going to be very annoyed if I haven't, because it's been a real effort to see them all. What's interesting, doing them a little bit later, is it shows you the films that last. There were films that I was like really, really love. And then you kind of think, oh, I haven't really thought about that film since. Yeah. You know what I mean? I won't name them. But like, that's an interesting thing that probably means this list might last a bit longer. I look back at some of my lists of films of the year that I've done and I go like, oh yeah, I forgot about that film. You know what I mean? That was number three on the list. Oh yeah. I was deeply in love with that film. I couldn't give a shit. You know what I mean?
I also think that because we do them from UK release dates, sometimes you sort of look at a movie and you go, didn't that come out 5 years ago?
Yeah.
And especially because, like, if we're doing a best of 2021, and I mean, we did start 2021 in an absolute classic lockdown. So it sort of feels so long ago.
Oh, and listen, everything is chaos. My new motto, everything is chaos. The rules used to be only from release date, UK release date, January the 1st to December 31st, and it has to have had a cinema release. I mean, now, who knows what anything is? I don't know what anything is anymore. So now it's like, it appeared somehow in the UK, somewhere, somehow, between January 1st and December 31st.
I went to see it in a dream. I went to see it in a dream.
You saw it in a dream within the year of 2021 in the UK. If you were on American soil dreaming, don't count. The film, you know, my current film of 2022, Mass, I saw that last year. In America.
Yes, right. Yes,
Everything is chaos.
Everything is absolute chaos. Yeah, I saw Licorice Pizza last year. But also, Brett, that's because you and I increasingly are managing to blag our way into early screenings of things.
That's true. There is that as well. We're very lucky boys.
The more Emmys you win, Brett, the more free films I see.
We're very lucky boys, but it does make this episode confusing, doesn't it? There are downsides to all this bloody stuff.
There are administrative issues, certainly, to executing it.
Now, one thing we should check in with you. Firstly, how is your tour going? I made a joke earlier about your tour, and I actually felt sick about it. It was purely a sort of rhythm joke. And I thought, it's not my cup of tea, that sort of joke, actually. I'm sort of deeply filled with shame. How is your tour?
Speaking of things that are deeply filled with shame, let's get on to my tour, for the love of God. My tour is, the UK tour is coming to an end. I've done, as we record, 51 dates, I think, and there are still another 10 to go.
In 51 performances of this show, how much has changed over the course of 51? How now, percentage-wise, how many different words are you saying in performance 51?
Well, there's like 10 minutes in the show that I kept flexible to accommodate for changing topical events. And that's changed sort of constantly. It's actually probably been the same for the last 2 weeks. That's the first time that's happened in the tour. I was just sort of constantly having to rewrite that bit. And then this kind of 70, 75 minutes that is pretty much steady and staying the same. You know, plus or minus the odd strange piece of audience behaviour or fun piece of audience behaviour. And so, yeah, and then I'm going to go and do that show. I'm doing it in America. I'm doing it in Canada. I'm doing it in Australia. I'm doing it everywhere.
Wow. You're doing it in Canada?
I'm going to do Montreal. I don't know if I should say that yet because it's not been announced, but I am doing Montreal. Also, who cares? I don't think there's any... This is not a Marvel movie release. This is not... I'm doing an hour of it in the middle of the next... Yeah, I'm doing an hour of it in the middle of the next Thor film. That's the next Thor film is just going to stop and I will just do my entire tour show in the middle of it.
I would absolutely love that. That's the sort of thing that would really shake up the universe and it's probably needed.
Yeah, the multiverse of madness would have been very strange if Doctor Strange had landed in one of the universes and it had just been him in the audience of my tour show.
Lucky Doctor Strange, I say. Now, the other thing we need to check in on your year, 2021, is I think, I could be wrong, but you've been on the podcast many times and every time you threaten to have therapy and never do. Have you
started? Brett, I've got such sensational news for you.
Go on.
I have started therapy.
Oh, I'm very proud of you. How is it going?
It's going very well, Brett. It's been a very useful process for me. I had a bit of the old PTSD due to some debt. Yeah, name drop. Sorry to drop a name so early in the podcast, Brett. Clang, but I've had a bit of the old PTSD.
Been offered some EMDR. Clang.
Ever heard the phrase CBT? Bong.
Someone's doing very well.
It was some, you know, some residual leftover problems from some death threats and some fallout from, you know, some unwanted press attention. But the process has been great. I'm embarrassed, of course, that it took me this long to do it. And I should also acknowledge the fact that my girlfriend and dear partner, Amy Annette, was very correct in suggesting that I have it many years ago. And I do, but I do delight in saying, boy, it's great that Brett finally convinced me to go to therapy. Isn't it great that Brett and Brett alone came up with the idea for me to take care of my mental health?
Yeah.
God, that guy is as generous and as knowledgeable as he is handsome. Yeah. The reason it's frustrating, well, for all of you, but the reason it's very frustrating for Amy is because Amy sort of said at the start of the process of me getting written about in the papers, and particularly with the sort of political and racial undertones of some of the writing, wouldn't it be useful if you did this preemptively? And that is not the Kumar family crest, which is the Kumar family motto is, why not wait until things get absolutely awful? And the family crest is just four people sat in a house on fire.
Sipping tea.
Yeah, sipping tea and waiting for the flames to start actively singeing them before they do anything productive about it. But it's, you know, it's been a great and fantastic process. And actually, it's an interesting thing to examine why I was so resistant to it. And it's been an interesting thing in terms of how it relates to me doing comedy. Like, in a lot of ways, it's actually helped me in terms of, you know, how I work on stage. But most importantly, it has sort of sorted out some of my, some of the old personal issues that I was having. And it's an ongoing process.
Can I ask how it affects you on stage? How it's changed your comedy? What do you mean by that?
I'm actually able to do, so the show that I'm doing is the most personal show I've ever done. And I think I'm only really able to talk about some of the issues around it because I have some perspective on them. I think there's an idea sometimes when people talk about stand-up comedy that it's like, I think it's largely because the way that stand-up comedy is depicted in popular culture is somebody goes, oh my God, I'm just feeling so depressed. And then they go on stage and they say, I'm depressed. And the audience goes, best comedy ever. Whereas in real life, if you walked out in front of an audience and said, I'm depressed, and then offered no punchline, someone would rightly phone the Samaritans.
Yeah.
You know, like it's you have to have some, you have to be talking about things that you have some sense of perspective on to tag a joke on the end of it.
I think you're giving a lot of credit to audiences in clubs. I think if someone came on and said, I'm depressed, and said nothing, someone would just go, get off the stage.
Yeah. They're just a bottle of beer
depressed.
Would smash
well,
next to them.
Fuck off then.
Yeah. Stop bringing us down. And how was your year, Brett? Emmy Award winner. There are another, like, 50 awards. SAG. You won the Saggiest Boobs Award, Brett.
I got Saggiest Boobs in Entertainment, which was an honour, a huge honour. And
but what a mad... Listen, if I may be earnest for a moment, Brett, I'm very proud of you.
If you may be earnest, guys,
I found your Emmy speech genuinely moving.
Well... Thank you, Nish. That's very kind of you to say, and I'm very grateful. Oh, I've forgotten to tell you something.
He's moving on. He can't talk about his success.
You've died. You're dead. You're dead again. You're dead. I just killed you. How did you die?
I can't remember how I've died before. I think, like, heart attack, bread roll to the face, crossing a road whilst listening to a podcast. I can't remember
all of the ways that I've died. That's right. That sounds about right. How are you doing this time? By my hands when you're trying to say nice things about me?
Yeah, that's it. That's why I died. Yeah, Brett choked me to death while I was trying to compliment him on his Emmy win.
Was it very cool? Very good death, actually. So here we are to talk about the films of the year. And so what I've done is sort of, I'm not going to ask all the questions, some of the questions, we'll see how we go. But we're kind of going to make it, we're going to do some questions, we'll answer them each, and then at the end we'll do our top 10, yeah? That's perfect. The general perfect format, isn't it?
And you know what we're going to try and do this time, Brett? We're going to try and keep it to one part, as opposed to last year's one, which spilled over into a sort of full, like, Godfather trilogy length.
So let's make this an acceptable listening experience rather than a grueling marathon.
Strap on your colostomy bags, everyone. I mean, it's a podcast. You could just take a shit and piss while you're listening to it. I don't know why you've chosen to do that, but strap them on.
Here we go. What was the first film you saw in 2021, Nish Kumar?
The first film I saw in 2021, I was watching in my house because we were in a lockdown, mm-hmm. and it was One Night in Miami.
Regina
King's film that was adapted by Kemp Powers from his own play, and it's about a fictionalized account of a night in a hotel room after Muhammad Ali won the heavyweight title, after he beat Sonny Liston the first time. And it's Muhammad Ali, Malcolm X, Sam Cooke, and Jim Brown. And it's this sort of alliance of sport, culture, and politics, and these four people that had a very, very significant imprint on culture and politics, particularly from an African-American perspective. And I enjoyed it. I think that it's always these kind of, these sort of fictionalized imaginings can sometimes feel a bit empty because you sort of go, well, at the end of the day, and how much of this, what's the point if none of this happened and it's all pure speculation? But I think that the writing managed to take in a lot of the kind of social, political and racial issues, but deliver them in a way that I think felt organic to the characters in the film. And I thought the performances were great. I mean, particularly Leslie Odom as Sam Cooke, I thought was just absolutely great. And it's kind of responsible for the sort of standout sequence, which is a kind of a memory Malcolm X has of watching him sing Chain Gang when the electrics in the venue has gone down. And for something that is quite, you know, is a theatrical adaptation, I thought it was a really nice, cinematic flourish to have in the middle of the film.
That's true. The film, it's fictionalized as in, I think this is right, we don't know what they said, but they did. They
we don't know what they said.
Hotel.
They were all together. Yeah. There are very, very famous photos which Malcolm X took, and there's some photos that Malcolm X is in this kind of milkshake bar that they were in, and they had to go to Miami because the fight had happened in a place that was segregated, and so they'd kind of gone out afterwards, and so we do know that these people were together that night.
I think it's great, and Kingsley Benadire's fucking great in it, and
really good.
I think he was sort of overlooked in the awards, and it's because he was quiet. It's always these quiet performances that get overlooked, and it's like he's being fucking brilliant. He's just he doesn't have a big shouty speech like that.
He's
so good in it. Anyway, I like that film. My answer is, I believe the first film I saw that year was Promising Young Woman.
Ah, very nice.
By the great and brilliant Emerald Fennell. And I love this film. I think it's fucking brilliant. And I think when I saw it, I was like, what's interesting about that film is it kind of became quite controversial. People turned against. There was real mixed, lots of people not liking it. And I felt like it was entirely that thing that happens where something, it was almost like an Edinburgh show in that it started as this small film. It was a small film that was coming from nowhere. And then it became a very big film and people were saying, this is the greatest film ever. And then I think people then have a million hot takes. And I was sort of annoyed by that because I was like, this is a really good film. And I kept comparing it to, it's not the same, but in terms of Get Out, I kept comparing it to Get Out in that it is a film about something incredibly serious. You know, it's basically a Me Too film, but it's fucking entertaining and it's thrilling and it's funny and it's scary and what it isn't is a heavy, difficult drama, which it very much could be. You know, there's a million ways of telling that. But what you don't expect is a kind of poppy, fun, almost roller coaster ride that still manages to get across the same very difficult messages and very challenging. It's incredibly challenging, that film. It really stayed with me. And And yet the experience of watching it is kind of a ride. It's fun. Like,
yeah.
I think it's fucking brilliant. I really think she's done an amazing job.
One of the things that I really enjoy is the sort of casting of the various terrible men and the use of McLovin from, I can't believe I just hit the G in McLovin. I think that's the most English thing I've ever done in my entire life. Ah, Mr. McLovin of the Scottish clan McLovin.
Yeah.
But McLovin, Schmidt from New Girl, and, you know, with all sort of spoiler alerts attached to it, obviously Bo Burnham as well, but by taking these kind of comedy soft boys and, you know, beloved sitcom character, beloved kind of beta male, a beta male in the context of Superbad, a film where everybody is a beta male, but taking the kind of beta-est beta male. And I thought that was a really interesting casting flourish, because actually these are men who are famous for being kind of this sort of soft boy, kind of slight nice guys. Like Schmidt in New Girl is the sort of softest version of a kind of womanizer that is possible to have. Yeah. And there was something powerful in taking the nice guys and having them be the abusers. Because, I mean, that's so much of what we understand about, you know, the kind of male predators. You know, we work in comedy. We know.
Oh yeah!
If there's one industry that doesn't need to be reminded that somebody can very much be sending out all the right signals but doing the absolute worst possible things, it's comedy.
What's the scariest film you saw in 2021 this year?
So listen, Brett, you know I've sort of gone on this journey where I like horror movies, and I stopped giving cute answers to this question.
Yeah,
and you know, stopped gone from inside Llewyn Davis and trying to sort of, you know, and stopped trying to be too clever about it. And I would love to have picked a straight up horror movie this year.
Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately, Brett, The Father is the most frightening film I've ever seen in my entire life. And I do think that there is some of the music cues and some of the way that it was shot felt like he was very consciously, I felt, borrowing from horror as a genre. And
I think it is absolutely a horror film. You're right. You can have that.
Yeah, it felt like a nightmare, you know, because what I thought was really terrifying about it was the idea, you know, the film is essentially set inside his mind effectively, you know, because at one point the flat is just a different flat and he's sort of almost not noticed that he's moved from one to the other. And so it's not even fair to say that it's set in the flat, because actually the location is shifting. The other actors are shifting. Olivia Colman becomes Olivia Williams. It's terrifying, but it's also terrifying from the perspective, which I think is a real skill of it, is that you also get a bit of Olivia Colman's perspective, which, given at one point she's played by a completely different actress, is genuinely remarkable. But you get the horror of her perspective of like slowly losing her father. But obviously, the horror from Anthony Hopkins' perspective of like his mind sort of slowly slipping away from him. And you just sort of think, how can this possibly end? There's a part of you that's like, is there some hope for it? No, it's just awful.
It's a really fucking horrible film. And I don't know why anyone would watch it. That's what I thought. Having watched it, I was like, why would anyone choose to watch this? This is a horrible.
I think, you know what? I think if you're like, if you're caring for, and I know this is something that people have expressed, if you're caring for somebody in that situation, seeing Olivia Colman's frustration and her guilt at that frustration, I think probably makes people in that position feel less alone and feel less guilty, because actually it's a very human and understandable emotion that when you're the primary caregiver for that person, there are points where you actively resent them. And that, because I was trying to work out as I was watching it, because I do think it's a brilliant, all the performances are brilliant. I also think adapting a play is really hard and turning it into a film. It's funny because we've already talked about two films, but this is like Florence Zeller wrote the play and has adapted it as into a film. And often when plays, really good plays, get turned into films, something gets lost because the structure of a play often doesn't lend itself well to cinema. And often there are long speeches that sometimes people don't necessarily break up. And now I haven't seen the play that this is based on, but I thought just as a piece of, if you can step back from the horror from it for a second, as a piece of adaptation of something that was originally written for the theatre, this movie was fucking cinematic. Yeah. Even though it's set in such a limited place, it used the tricks of cinema and the fact that things can shift and change within a scene and we can loop back and see the same footage again. I thought it used the tricks of cinema really brilliantly. And just sort of purely on a technical perspective, I thought that it was a really impressive piece of adaptation. But I mean, as a film, I mean, it's absolutely horrific. It's this is the darkest thing you could ever see.
Yeah.
It's the darkest.
Listen, it's very well made. And I think having the two Olivias play the same part is really, really smart casting because they do look slightly similar and they are named the same and you often people confuse them. I think not people without dementia confuse those two. Anyway, that's brilliant. But still, why on earth would you watch that film, make that film and go through it? It is very depressing, that film. My goodness me. What a dark
it's
film. Very good.
It's a horror movie. It's a horror movie.
It's a fucking horror movie.
At the most purest level, it is the most sort of deeply horrific thing you can imagine. I think my mother's review of that is probably my favorite review of the year. My mother watched it and said, I mean, at the end of the day, why do we bother? And I don't know whether she was talking about the film. I don't know whether she was talking about life, Brett. I don't know if she was talking about being alive.
That is
at the end of the day, why do we bother?
That's the takeaway of that film.
Oh, at the end of the day, why do we bother, Mrs. Coomer? Imagine that on the posters.
As the flames are going around their house. At the end of the day, why do we bother? Sipping that tea.
What was your scariest film?
I couldn't think of that many scary films I saw, but I guess the closest to a horror film I saw, which I was surprised how much I really enjoyed, was In the Earth, the Ben Wheatley film that he made during the pandemic, during lockdown, I believe he made it. Have you seen it?
No, I haven't seen this movie.
Talk
to me about it.
It's good fun. It's good fun. It's set in the woods, in the earth, and Joel Fry, who is excellent, is like a scientist going into the woods during a unnamed pandemic, and there's just a cool thing that is all the trees are communicating with each other through the soil, which I believe is factual, but that there's sort of like, you know, the earth is sort of maybe out to get us, I think is the point of it. And in the end, it all goes mad and psychedelic and sort of...
He likes a bit of that, like, old Wheatley.
He does like a bit of it, but I really enjoyed it. It's good, and it's got Reese Shearsmith in it as a nutter. It's kind of funny. It's just very odd. And it's impressive because I think they made it in like, it's one of them films you watch. And I think they made it in 6 days in the woods or something. You're like, how did you do this? Fucking hell. And it's quite fun. It's quite fun as well. I liked it.
Yeah. Yeah. Did it have scary elements to it? Or is it more the like broad
thematic? It is scary. Reese Shearsmith is scary. He's this nutter in the woods. And like, there's a moment where he, there's sort of this like horrible, like funny, dark, like I think Joel Fry injures his toe and Reese Shearsmith, who lives in the woods, is like, well, we have to chop it off then. And there's this whole long thing of him trying to chop off his toe, like, well, just hold still. And you're just like, fucking hell, no. Oh God. There's a lot of that. And Joel Fry, what's funny is Joel Fry is quite polite through the whole thing. Just was like, oh, I'd rather you didn't, you know, I'd rather you didn't chop off my toe.
Reese Shearsmith would be top of my list of British comedic actors who would do a 1 hour photo style or insomnia style, starring as a real, because Reese Shearsmith's comedy, even when he's playing comedic characters, he's sort of on the edge of being really scary.
Yeah, he's scary. He is. Maureen, what's this I hear about you going to film school? I am. I want to gain valuable skills while making films and developing my creativity, so I'm attending the New York Film Academy. I'm thinking about becoming one of them people that writes the numbers on the title board. NYFA is a very respected film school.
I hear they offer a variety of options to meet your educational goals, whether you want a BFA or MFA degree or want to learn at a quicker pace with a short-term programme. That's right. They've got workshops and summer camps in filmmaking, acting, cinematography, screenwriting, producing, game design, musical theatre and more. Are you attending in New York? Might do. They have multiple campuses in some amazing locations like New York, LA, Miami, Italy, Australia and online. And you can learn more about the New York Film Academy at nyfa.edu. That's nyfa.edu. Thanks, Maureen.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase, every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
What is the film that made you cry the most, Nish Kumar, you big softy?
Well, I think we're going to talk about this. I'm going to guess that we're going to talk about this film in some detail at some point over the course of this show. So all I will say is, at points in... when I watched Come On, Come On, I thought I was, it's probably the only time I've genuinely thought that I would have to leave the cinema.
Really?
Because I was absolutely inconsolable through various points. I think it's an absolute sort of miracle of a film. I really, really loved it deeply. And I think it's something that we will probably come back to at some point in the conversation. But I would just say
it.
In terms
of... about it now.
Sheer volume of tears. Come On, Come On, it just, you know, it hit home in a way that I thought I actually found. I know that I've read mixed reviews of it. Mm. I've read people saying that they found the documentary elements felt sort of tacked on. I thought that that was absolutely brilliant. I love the incorporation of those real interviews. The premise of the film is that, you know, Joaquin Phoenix is also a slightly portly bearded creative. So, I mean, amazingly, Brett, I somehow found a way to see myself in that character. I somehow managed to find myself in this somewhat shambolic, unshaven man who works in the media. I don't know how I did that. This is the thing about cinema, Brett. Yeah. It's the empathy machine, and you can cross all sorts of boundaries if you just try and step out of your comfort zone for 1 second.
It's really impressive. This therapy's really working. Look how broad, look how broad your mind is.
It's like when I said that I enjoyed, this was years ago, when I told my friend that I enjoyed Funny People, and he was like, of course you did. If you don't enjoy Funny People, then no one has enjoyed Funny People. But yeah, I thought the black and white photography was stunning. I thought Joaquin Phoenix was incredible. I love him. You know, I really dislike The Joker. I really deeply dislike it as a film. And one of the reasons I resent the fact that he won an Oscar for that, because I just think he's done versions of that before. Like, I think his performance in The Master is the performance that people seem to think he gave in The Joker. Like, I think he's so good in The Master. And I loved this version of him. I loved the slightly sweeter, gentler side of him. His sister is kind of dealing with her partner's mental health problems and trying to get him to help himself. So he kind of has his nephew foisted on him.
Your girlfriend was going, I really relate to this film. And you're like, what is going on with the two of us? This film is for us.
But he kind of has this kid sort of foisted on him. And there's an interesting backstory where, you know, something like he's him and his sister clearly are close. Mm. And Gabby Hoffman is great in the movie as well. But him and his sister are clearly close, but you very quickly establish that there's been some sort of schism, and you sort of slowly discover over the course of the film what that is and the shape of it. But I thought the kid was brilliant. Mm. I thought the kid was great. And I just thought that his, like, I think there's something like, if you're sort of a person who has been around children as an older person, there's something very relatable about the slow discovery of how difficult it is to be a parent. And the idea that being a fun uncle is like actually quite easy, but actually having to look after them on a day-to-day basis is incredibly stressful. And the way that it helps rebuild his relationship with his sister. And I just thought that, again, like I love, you know, I love title tracks in films, and I love when the film gets its title from, the kid has a sort of monologue. And again, the kid was brilliant and the kid could so easily have been annoying.
Yeah.
But yet the kid was only annoying when the kid was supposed to be annoying. I just thought that it was like, I thought it was so beautifully done, and it made me laugh, and I found it so profoundly moving.
Mm-hmm. That fucking ending, I'd forgotten how fucking lovely that ending is. But also it's like the whole film, I believe you would call it humanist. Is that what we would call such a film?
Yeah.
Where it's like, it's almost kind of too lovely in terms of, I was thinking of it like, I'd almost show it to your mum after watching The Father. Watch Come On, Come On. And it's like it's like an hour and a half, however long it is, of like lovely, believing people, his thoughtful, sensitive relationships, everyone sort of coming from a place of kindness and love. It's a really lovely, lovely film.
Yeah. I just thought it was beautiful. And I just found that relationship so plausible and sweetly drawn. And I sort of loved all the interviews with the real kids talking about growing up in America. And I just thought it was, you know, somebody struggling to manage their partner's mental health. I thought that was really beautifully drawn. And like, she could have been sort of left out, given the most important dynamic is the dynamic between Joaquin Phoenix's character and the kid, Jesse. It could so easily have marginalized her, but actually she's brilliant in the film. And you get a real sense, a three-dimensional sense of that dynamic that exists, particularly between the three of them. And the Jesse saying, it is hard, it is really horrible, but you just have to come on. And like, there's something about just expressing that as a kid expressing that, that felt really sort of organic. And I do find myself thinking sometimes, okay, I know, but you just gotta come on.
That, I hadn't even thought of that. That's beautiful, man.
Yeah. What was the film that made you cry the most?
I think it was Pig, the Nicolas Cage film. Pig. Have you seen Pig?
So I didn't see this movie, but I having read about it, I do deeply regret not having seen it.
Pig is fucking brilliant. And I think what's weird about it is, I don't know if I cried loads, but I definitely cried. And it was like surprising, because no one, or certainly I wasn't going into a film in which Nicolas Cage is trying to get back his truffle pig that's been stolen. And there's lots of scenes of him going, where is my pig? I didn't think that this film would be a profound meditation on grief and incredibly moving. It's so good. It's so good. And it's beautiful and it's odd. And it does, I almost don't want to spoil anything, but what I will say is it kind of suggests a load of tropes that happen in films and then takes a very surprising route with them. And it's deep. It's like, it's a kind of metaphorical and allegorical, all these things, but it's also just specific to this weird story of a man and his truffle pig. It's fucking beautiful. It's really good. I think it's his best film for many times.
It's nice. Just every so often, he just goes,
"Yeah,
I actually can do this."
Yeah, and it's just such a surprising film, because the trailer, it seems like it could be, oh, it's Cage doing a mad Nicolas Cage film.
Yeah, right.
But it's not mad. It's beautiful, and he's so understated in it. And oh, it's great. Highly recommend Pig.
Wow.
Beautiful. I also cried in No Way Home. All right.
Talk to me about that, Brett. That's very interesting to me, because obviously I cried in No Way Home, Brett.
Yeah.
Obviously. Yeah. Because I am Spider-Man and I love Spider-Man.
Yeah.
But like, you know, what do I love, Brett? I love Spider-Man and I love Richard Linklater movies where he films them over 30 years and everyone ages in real time.
Yeah.
The No Way Home is the closest the MCU is ever going to get to Before Sunrise and Before Sunset.
I was really impressed with the writing of No Way Home. As in, I worry about, if I can say such a thing, I worry about art eating itself. I worry about, you know, whatever you want to call it, fan service, the thing of, let's bring back everything we've ever loved and put everything together in one big thing of everything, and let's never do anything new and just keep bringing back old stuff and putting it in new things. It worries me that. However, if you are going to do it, I think Spider-Man No Way Home was as good as you can ever do that. It was so well crafted and written, and the use of, spoiler alert, Tobey Maguire and Andrew Garfield, I thought was genuinely beautiful and felt meaningful, felt like here's a way of answering questions that were left, of fixing things that weren't quite right, of like, it was really genuinely a lovely thing. If we're all going to eat ourselves and that's it, what a way to go.
I think it's sort of an argument potentially to never do it again, almost, because I don't know how you could. And like, I don't want to give too much away. We could talk maybe more about this at the end of 2023 when we do our best of 2022. But I've seen some films that have come out outside of the year that we're discussing that maybe don't do it as well. And they may or may not exist in the same cinematic universe as Spider-Man No Way Home. But the reason it works is that they make it work in the context of the plot of the film. And also, I just don't think, you know, in terms of like, I just don't think they've put a foot wrong with any of the Spider-Man films. I think they deliver what those films are supposed to deliver. They're really entertaining. They're very fun. And the chemistry, particularly between the three teenage leads, I think is just great. It's just great and works really beautifully in every film. But yeah, I did think Andrew Garfield, Tobey Maguire, I did think it was done really, really beautifully. I think it's a huge compliment. It's not a compliment to the film that I cried through that. It would have been a profound failure on their part if I hadn't just wept through the whole of Spider-Man No Way Home, because it's so bound up in my whole childhood. I insisted on dressing as Spider-Man from the neck down for my third birthday. My mum wouldn't let me put the mask on, and the compromise was that I wore entirely, I don't know, I was
Is it because she was worried people wouldn't recognise you?
Yeah, I think she was. I was trying to protect my secret identity. This woman is giving it away left, right, and center.
I'd love it if you're walking around with the Spider-Man mask on and everyone's at your birthday going, where's Nish though? he's put the mask on, we can't, I don't know where he is.
But so for me, just seeing Tobey Maguire in the Spidey suit and like that. But I do think, I genuinely thought it worked really well. And I was surprised because Into the Spider-Verse was brilliant.
Yeah.
And they managed to sort of do something else with essentially the same raw materials. But I thought, it's almost as good as superhero films get, I think. It's funny. Yeah. It's sweet. It's the leads are all very charismatic. And I thought they managed to kind of code some character significance into the action sequences, you know, and Andrew Garfield sort of rescuing MJ and resolving his character's trauma is a nice little moment. And they do it very nicely.
It's very good. What is the film that you love, but most people don't? It certainly wasn't critically acclaimed, but you love it.
Why don't you tell me what yours was?
I've decided that mine was, because I had a few of them, but the one I'm going to go with was the M. Night Shyamalan film, Old.
Wow. Here we go.
I liked Old, and I stand by Old. Here's the truth of what I think is the thing with Old. I think, this is pure speculation, I have no idea how it really worked, I think that what was filmed was probably a fairly early draft. I think Old is filled with really good ideas, really great concepts. All the elements are there. It just hasn't quite been knitted into a seamless quilt of a film. But all the patches are there. And they could have been put together a slightly slicker, maybe, or some, I don't know what the word is. But I love the ideas of Old. I love the ending. I love the concept. I loved the various cool, scary, weird ideas that she gets pregnant and then 5 minutes later is giving birth, and those sort of things that happen. And then it was actually quite moving in the end. And when he says, I don't even remember what we were fighting about, it's beautiful. Like, it's got everything in it. It's just not quite put together in the best way it probably could be, but I really like it. And I salute you, M. Night Shyamalan. And why bother doing more rewrites?
If I may, speak in defense of my fellow gentleman of South Asian extraction.
Yeah.
They're always filled with really interesting ideas. Whether they're executed well or not, is a different thing. But if you think about how seriously Unbreakable took the superhero genre and where we are with superhero movies now, you're sort of like, it, you know, there's lots of really interesting, they're all, even Science, which I think is an absolute piece of shit, it is an interesting concept. Like, there are really interesting ideas and concepts kind of at work in all of these movies.
Did you like Old?
I wouldn't go that far. But it's like, it's really interesting. They're always, especially if you like genre movies, there is always something interesting going on in these movies.
And I think he's a good director. I think he's a. I think he shoots them well. I'm going to stand by my M. Night Shyamalan.
Yeah.
What's your answer? What's the film you love that not many people do?
I would say, I think this might have been pretty well reviewed, but I mean, I would say it's one of the strongest cups of coffee I've ever taken in my life as a film. It's a really bitter black cup of coffee. But The Card Counter, the Paul Schrader movie.
Okay, I saw it.
I went to see it with my brother and my dad, and we all actually quite liked it. But I've had nothing but I've been met with resistance outside of that. I thought that it was great. I thought it was great. I thought it was. It's bleak. It's kind of relentlessly bleak. And I think the ending is supposed to offer you some sense of redemption or hope. I thought Oscar Isaac was great in it. I mean, there's some elements of it that are like, I mean, the lead character's name is William Tell. You know, like, there's bits of it that feel almost risible in. But I thought Willem Dafoe was great, and I thought it grappled with something that cinema hasn't, American movies have not really properly engaged with. There are very few good War on Terror movies. And there is certainly, especially when you compare it to the sort of glut of Vietnam movies and even things like Taxi Driver that are sort of Vietnam adjacent. And this, I think, is Schrader sort of trying to write Taxi Driver for the War on Terror and the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, because again, we're watching it through the prism of a veteran. But the difference between Oscar Isaac's character and Travis Bickle is that he knows he's profoundly damaged. And so he's actually trying, you know, Travis Bickle is a man walking around with a set of psychological traumas that he's picked up from being at war that he doesn't know about. And Oscar Isaac is a guy who knows that he has those traumas and but isn't able to deal with them, but instead has removed himself from society. So it's another Schrader, God's Lonely Man movie. And his relationship with this young kid that he encounters, who we sort of slowly realize his father has a connection to Oscar Isaac's backstory. And then his this kind of romance that happens between him and Tiffany Haddish. Also, I didn't know what Tiffany Haddish, she's a brilliant actor, but I didn't know how she functioned in a Schrader movie. And I thought what was lovely was actually she kind of brought her own personality to it, and that Schrader sort of found room for that in this kind of movie. But it grappled with, you know, the military industrial complex and the part that it played in Iraq and Afghanistan. Willem Dafoe playing this kind of, you know, a representation of these faceless subcontractors that were involved in places like Guantanamo Bay. I think Oscar Isaac is extraordinary, and I liked seeing him with the kind of charisma turned, like, deliberately dialed down. Mm-hmm. I liked seeing quite an internal performance. I also just like, I found an unlikely point of relatability, just in terms of, you know, going into a hotel room and covering up the furniture.
Really?
just because anything you can do to personalize a hotel room. Me, Oscar, for me, I take an HDMI cable so I can plug my computer into the screen. That's how you've decided to do it, because you're only really comfortable in prison. And I mean, it's quite a different thing. You're sort of dealing with a lot of traumas from military prison. And I just spent quite a lot of time in travel lodges in the late 2000s. Quite different situations, but just, you know, anything you can do to make yourself feel more at home in a hotel room. But I just thought it was a very strong and bleak cup of coffee of a film.
Very well argued. special shout out in this category to Army of the Dead and Don't Look Up, both of which I enjoyed.
Interesting.
I don't care. I'll just say this about Don't Look Up. I'm one of the few defenders of Don't Look Up. I think that the people that don't like Don't Look Up want it to be a different film than what it is. That's what I think.
Yeah.
That's my hot take. It isn't the film that you want it to be, but the film that it is very entertaining. I got no beef with it. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah. I know what you mean. I think I would be somebody who I hate to be the person who's like, I actually thought it was okay. I didn't absolutely loathe it.
Right.
And I didn't absolutely love it. I'm, you know, it feels like I'm deliberately trying to annoy everybody. Yeah. But I thought there were bits of it. I'm a fan of the kind of righteous hectoring Adam McKay movies. You know, like I liked Vice. I liked A Big Short. I share his politics and his inability to not scream them in your face. You know, it would be a bold move for me to start castigating people for yelling their politics at people, given that that's what I do every single fucking night of my goddamn life. But I thought the analogy, if somebody was doing stand-up about climate change and the analogy that they drew was a meteor, I would sort of say that it doesn't quite track as an analogy. Just because, like, if that was the case, we would have had 50 years of a kind of pro-meteor lobby funding pro-meteor sentiment in the press, you know? And I think this isn't something that's kind of come out of the sky. This is something that's brewed and brewed and brewed and something that's been allowed to ferment. You know,
you've absolutely ruined it now.
BP hired Ogilvy & Mather, an advertising company, to popularise a semi-obscure piece of academia called the carbon footprint. And the reason they did that was they wanted people to focus on their carbon footprint, even though an individual actually can't do anything. And, you know, oil companies and governments, you know, the American Chinese governments and then oil companies like BP, you know, they should be talking about their carbon footprint. Like, I'm sorry, but like, as individuals, we can only move the dial so much. And yes, it is good to be aware of your carbon footprint, but that was a piece of corporate marketing by BP. And that's what I think I missed from Don't Look Up. But that doesn't preclude me from being guilty of exactly what you've just said, which is wanting it to be a different film than it was. But for me, if I was watching somebody do stand up about climate change and they tried to draw that analogy, I would say, but you know, where is the pro meteor lobby? Because that's basically...
I love that. Where's the pro meteor lobby? What? I said sorry, mate. What? Where's the pro meteor lobby? I don't know what you're talking about. I'm just trying to do my set. Boo! Okay. What's the
basically what I've said? What I've done is I've said, Adam McKay, I see your capacity to humorlessly crowbar your politics into another irrelevant subject matter, and I will raise you.
What a cliffhanger. What's the answer? Oh my God, I guess you'll have to find out next week. So that was episode 198. Head over to patreon.com/Brett Goldstein for the extra chat, secrets and videos with Nish. Don't forget to get your tickets for the live show at the Hackney Empire, July 2nd. Tickets at hackneyempire.co.uk or plosive.co.uk. We'll have fun. Oh, what a time we've had. So, thank you so much to Nish for giving me this time. Thanks to Scroobius Pip and the Distraction Pieces Network. Thanks to Buddy Peace for producing it. Thanks to Acast for hosting it. Thanks to Adam Richardson for the graphics and Lisa Lydon for the photography. Come join me next week for part two of the perfectly timed end of year films of 2021 special part two. Hope you're all well. Thank you for listening. That is it for now. In the meantime, have a lovely week and please be excellent to each other.
Brett, sometimes I dream of becoming an actor. Have you ever dreamt of becoming an actor? Maureen, what is it you think I do for a living? Never mind, sounds like you need the New York Film Academy. NYFA offers workshops, BFA and MFA degrees and summer camps in filmmaking, acting, journalism and more, online and on campuses across the globe. To make films alongside industry professionals, explore more at nyfa.edu. Thanks, Brett. Thank you, Maureen.
Maureen, your Canva presentation looks brilliant. Thanks, Brett. That's because I used AI-powered Canva presentations. I just described what I wanted, and Canva presentations generated the perfect slides. You can even make a talking presentation for people to watch on their own time. Check this out. Recording. 101 Reasons Why Beaches is the Saddest Film Ever Made by your neighbour Maureen. Is it easy to use? If you can use a computer, you can nail your next work presentation with Canva presentations at canva.com, designed for work. Oh, thanks, my name is Maureen. Yeah, thank you.